This is Dr. J with Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your radio tuned to the left and your mind in the open position as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
I'm speaking with Alex Hurd, author of Apocalypse Pretty Soon, Travels in End Time America from W.W. Norton. It's history, part cultural anthropology, part gonzo journalism, travel log about millennial and utopian groups in the U.S. Alex Hurd is formerly with the New York Times Magazine and now an executive editor at Wired Magazine. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you.
You start your book with an introduction that talks about your bout with meningitis and how it was apocalypse in your head. How did you see that relating to your growing fascination with millennial cults?
Well, back then, I lived in Washington, D.C. I was a freelance writer back then, and I got a viral encephalitis, which is a strange disease that makes you feel like you're losing control of your mind a little bit. It's not really deadly like bacterial meningitis, but it does affect your brain, and it gave me this period of delusion that lasted a few weeks, and I really briefly experienced what it felt like to feel like you're losing your mind. And one thing it did was kind of put in relative terms just what can happen to your mind. And, you know, I went back to normal, but it left me realizing that, you know, rationality is kind of a relative thing. And about that time, my interest in subcultures in general broadened into an interest in millennial groups, because I was just thinking about the coming of the 90s, and at that time I got some mailings from people who happened to be apocalyptic in a way that seemed kind of crazy. And it just occurred to me to start poking around in that area and try to find out, like, what the people behind these ideas, what was going on with them? And were they really crazy, or were they was their reality distortion field adjusted different from mine?
Well, of course, the dominant form of millennial and apocalyptic expectation in the country is Christian fundamentalism, and you have a chapter summarizing different Christian fundamentalist trends. An enormous subculture of people in our country believe in end times revelatory beliefs. And can you summarize for us briefly, what's the difference between a premillennialist and a postmillennialist? What's the wrath? What's the rapture?
Okay. First of all, you're right about that being the largest group. I would say I've seen estimates that there are 20, 23 million Americans who believe in the prophecies of the end times as they see outlined in the book of Revelation. That's a huge number, and they're right now on Amazon.com, the online bookseller, I think like five of the, you know what, I'm getting a terrible echo.
Okay, go ahead.
About five of, still am.
Let's see.
It's just bouncing really. Let me try it. That's better.
Okay.
We're taping, right?
Yeah, I can edit this out.
Okay. I think four or five of the top 100 selling books are from a seven-part series of novels about the end times by Timothy LaHaye,
mm-hmm.
who's a fundamentalist preacher.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. So those books are selling in the millions, not just the hundreds of thousands, which is a runaway bestseller on the New York Times list. Wouldn't sell as many of these things. So there's a large underground body of people who are interested in this stuff. Now, it comes from an interpretation of the Bible that the majority of Christians don't buy into. We inherit it from a man in England named John Nelson Darby, who came up with the idea of a particular type of analysis of what the Book of Revelation said and how it relates to other prophecy-oriented books in the Bible, like Daniel, which is crucial. And he was the person who worked out this very elaborate timetable of when the end times will start, when Antichrist will rise and start attacking Israel, and Christ's return comes at some point at the end of a seven-year period of tribulation. And that's the Battle of Armageddon that everyone's heard of. Now, it's if you've read the Book of Revelation, you know that it's almost impossible to make anything of what's in there.
Mm-hmm.
So he has attempted to do that, and he used books like Daniel to try to figure out how long it would all take. That's where they get the idea that it will last 7 years. And he was the person, Darby came up with the idea of the rapture, which is a belief that before the tribulation starts, faithful Christians will be lifted into heaven so that they will be spared these terrible times that will play out here on earth before the second coming and the onset of a millennium of peace. So what you find among Christians who believe this now, it's evolved over the years, but they argue a lot about when the rapture will occur. And you mentioned the term pre-tribulational. Those are people who believe that the rapture will occur prior to the tribulation, which is the seven-year period of terror brought by Antichrist. There are other people who are called post-tribbers, who are convinced that Christians will have to live through that period just like anyone else. And these distinctions sound kind of bizarre, but they're very important, because if you believe this, it's the most important thing in history. And you would want to know whether you're going to suffer these terrible tortures and trials, or whether you'll be in heaven sort of looking down on it all.
Now, you focus some attention on one of the subsects of Christian millennialists and Jewish millennialists, which is those who believe that the reestablishment of the State of Israel and the Israel occupation of Jerusalem sets the stage for the reconstruction of the temple.
Right.
And that the temple is necessary for the return of either the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah, or the second coming of Christ.
Right.
And there are people who are preparing for the rebuilding of the temple. Can you describe some of those groups?
Yeah, first of all premillennialists believe that Israel is crucial, because the coming of the millennium is the last stage in God's dealing with the nation of Israel. Israel is always at the center of these end-time events. Now, that said, there are some people within this group we've been talking about who look at the prophecies and believe that they read into it that there must be a third temple on the Temple Mount. And it needs to be there because at some point during the tribulation, the Antichrist will set up his reign inside the temple, desecrating it. It's called the Abomination of Desolation. And the idea is that he'll be in there and he'll be perverting what the temple is supposed to be about. So for the if you use reverse logic, for that to happen, the temple must be rebuilt someday. Therefore, there are Christians and some Jews, as you probably know, who desperately would like to see a temple rebuilt. And one of the chapters in my book is about a Pentecostal minister in Mississippi named Reverend Clyde Lott. And he has taken on a specific role in all this. His reading of the Bible tells him that there will need to be a temple. And he believes that if there will be a temple, there needs to be a functioning priesthood complete with all the sacrifices practiced by the Israelites in ancient times. One of the many things they would need is an unblemished red heifer, which is a red virginal cow. And this would be sacrificed, burned, and the ashes produced are used in certain temple purification rituals. So, taking all this literally, Reverend Lott has decided that we will need red heifers to be ready when the temple goes up. So he's got an ambitious project, you know, he's spending tens of thousands on it. He's an old cattleman, and he's producing red Angus, and he's planning to ship a herd of them over to Israel so that they can take hold over there, and they'll be used as livestock. But he wants the perfect red heifer to be just ready to go when the time comes, when for whatever reason the third temple is possible.
Now, there are Jewish groups who believe this as well, and they've linked up with these fundamentalist Christians.
Yeah, there's one of his friends over there is a rabbi named Chaim Richman, who's actually from Boston originally. And as you probably know, a lot of Jews with messianic ideas really come from the United States and go to Israel. Some of the most fervent people on the idea came from here. So through a long series of events, Lot and Richman found out about each other, and they formed a friendship, you know, through the mail. This was several years ago. And when I visited in Mississippi, I went to Lot's ranch to see the red heifers that he has produced already. The rabbi was there visiting to speak to Lot's congregation. So it was an amazing confluence of cultures. The people in this Pentecostal congregation who came to hear the rabbi speak, most of them had never seen a Jewish person in their lives, they told me. And far from having negative stereotypes, they might have had stereotypes, but they were positive stereotypes. To them, having a Jewish rabbi in their midst talking about the red heifer and its importance was a supremely sacred moment, and they were honored to have him there. Now, it's all a little strange to outsiders, and someone could reasonably argue that is a stereotype of what a Jew is about. I wouldn't argue against that, but my point is that all this, as strange as it is done in the spirit of goodwill. These people believe these prophecies. They don't intend to hurt anybody, and they just think they're living out the truth as they believe it. Now, you were going to say something?
Yeah, one of the themes of your book comes out that you bring your book around in the end to a description of the Christian identity cult, the groups who believe that Jews are in fact descendants of Satan, and that only white people are descended, the true chosen people. But your point about that is that while many cultural anthropologists or journalists would focus on groups like Christian Identity in order to show that the fringe is dangerous, scary, racist, most of the people that you met were, in terms of their venality or their dangerousness, the ordinary representation of America, that there were as the same proportion of dangerous people in the groups that you were looking at as there were in the general population.
Right. I would say the vast majority of people I met were harmless, unless you think strange ideas are somehow harmful.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, mentioning Christian Identity is a good point. In all these areas, there is an offshoot that isn't harmless and is very scary. The numbers of the people are involved are small, but it doesn't take a lot of people. So millennial and apocalyptic ideas always have a dark side that involves a minority of people. You know, I have a chapter about a flying saucer religion and whose members are waiting for a mass landing of spaceships. It's a similar idea to Heaven's Gate, but with these people, it's all kind of kooky and harmless, and they're never going to kill themselves to try to make it happen sooner. And yet, the same ideas just went sour with those Heaven's Gate people, and they decided that the way to hurry things up was to commit mass suicide. Same way with Clyde Lott and his fantasy about a third temple. At the same time that I think that he's essentially harmless, he's involved in something that can give other people very dangerous ideas, because if you followed the history of Israel, you know that over the years, individuals and groups have decided, yes, there does need to be a third temple, and God needs me to do something about it so that it can happen. And what's up there now are Muslim shrines, most famously the Dome of the Rock. There have been people who have tried to sneak up there and dynamite the place. And their idea is that once it's cleared, no matter what happens, there will probably be a war, and Israel will prevail, and they will have control of the Temple Mount again. So that's a scary idea. And I talked to someone, a former member of Israeli intelligence, who said that fantasies about the Temple Mount are considered very serious and very scary over there. And if you remember, a few months ago, there was a group from Colorado, Christian cultists who call themselves Concerned Christians, some of them were rounded up because the intelligence people had decided that when the year 2000 arrived, they were planning to go on some sort of armed rampage to try to put everything in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And it all was probably would have been centered on or around the Temple Mount.
Another one of the Christian-inflected millennial groups that you discuss, which was totally new to me, and believe me, I try to pay attention to these things, is Earth Changes. And it seemed like a bizarre fusion of radical ecology and New Age ideas with apocalyptic Christianity. Is that the origin of it?
That's a good way to put it. Let's tell people a little bit about it. Earth Changes is an idea that the planet itself has a consciousness and is able to regulate its systems in a way that protects itself. And it's a lot of themes come into this, but the basic idea is that Earth right now is producing more natural disasters and new diseases, and global warming is getting hotter, and all these things are combining to devastate the environment, and the end result is that the majority of people living on the planet now will be killed off in a literal period of apocalyptic upheaval involving earthquakes, rising floods, asteroids hitting the planet, and if you look at maps that the Earth Changes believers produce, they show what the U.S. and the world will look like after the Earth Changes are over. Most of the West in the U.S. is missing. New York is completely underwater. Half of Florida is gone. And as you said, there are various themes play into this. But one of the origins, of course, is from the Bible, just myths of flood and regeneration. One of the prime sources is Nostradamus, the French seer and mystic from centuries ago, who supposedly foresaw great calamitous upheavals in our time that matched the predictions of Earth Changes believers. But probably the most direct and important influence was an American-born psychic, now deceased, named Edgar Cayce, who you've probably heard of. He went into these trance states where he saw things and talked about them, and people wrote down what he was saying. A lot of the readings, as they were called, had to do with health matters and other spiritual things, but a lot of them were about Earth Changes. He saw Atlantis rising again, and a portion California dropping into the sea. So, Earth Changes is probably a subculture that involves tens of thousands of people around the country. And they ball all this stuff together, and they look at real headlines in the news about the weather or about the Antarctic ice shelf, and some of them have concluded it's definitely happening, things are getting worse all the time, and therefore I need to build a survival shelter. So you get the same sort of end result as you're getting with the Y2K panic. A belief that you really need to be prepared to ride out a period of turbulence that will be like nothing we've ever seen before.
By the way, I'm talking with Alex Hurd, author of Apocalypse Pretty Soon, a recent book out. Alex, the book that you've written focuses on secular groups as well. You mentioned the Unarians, UFO cult, and you also have a chapter about abductee and contactee groups and the role of Stephen Greer in those groups. We've recently done a show on the book Aliens in America, so we're familiar with some of that. I was surprised, however, we recently did a show with Charles Platt, and we talked to him about the free energy subculture and the underground network of scientists and entrepreneurs researching anti-gravity and free energy. You seem to link a lot of that to the UFO conspiracy crowd. Can you talk a little bit about those connections?
Yeah, although with what Platt is writing about, he's mainly, at least when he's writing at Wired, he's talking about cold fusion research.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are gradations here. The people that he's interested in are not the same ones I was writing about. They're not tied into UFO conspiracy theories. But there is a subset within this subculture of people. There's a subculture of people who think that sources of energy exist that would free us from bondage to fossil fuels, and these are being held, the truth about this is being held back by the government. And you find this weird overlap with people who say the same things about flying saucers and extraterrestrials. There's a subculture of people who insist that the aliens have landed and the bodies are in a hangar somewhere, and all these things you've heard before. What I found was that there's overlap. The same people who say we're not being told the truth about the aliens often will say we're not being told the truth about free energy. So I tried to find out, you know, why is that? Who are the people saying this, and why are they saying it? So I visited with several free energy inventors. The ones I talked to, for example, a man named Stanley Meyer, who has since passed away, were just outright crackpots who, in his case, I think he was a charlatan. He was trying to sell people shares of an engine that ran on water, supposedly. And you could pay $50,000 to secure geographical rights, sort of like a McDonald's franchise, for a day sometime in the future when his invention was actually ready. But he was always talking about government conspiracies to murder him, you know, so that his physics, his revolutionary physics, would never come to light. And why people do this, I think sometimes they believe it. I think sometimes it's part of an elaborate con, because if you say that the government is trying to get you, then you can keep certain things secret that might be of interest to people you're trying to sell your information to. So it's a very murky subculture, and it's always more complicated than it's depicted on the X-Files, for example, because there is always something real happening, and the government is covering it up. In the UFO and free energy worlds, often people are talking about ideas that are not happening. I mean, none of the people I've ever heard of have a free energy machine. So even though they're alleging cover-up and government interference, they're talking about kind of a phantom activity, because there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important distinction. So Stephen Greer, who believes that the UFOs are here and that a super, super secret team is lying to us about it, I don't think he's right. And he spends all his time talking about dark conspiracies involving the CIA and, you know, a secret team within the government. But I think it's all just sort of a shadow play.
Yeah. One of the interesting things in your book is that although many folks who write about these things are either entirely skeptical, as we've said, or have a kind of alleged objectivity, like some cultural anthropologists might allege, you explicitly try to assign whether people are avaricious in their approach or deluded or neurotic, and you see Stephen Greer as one of the negative types out there.
Yes, I don't think he's greedy or a con man either. I just think that he believes, and this is based on talking to people who used to work with him and later broke off. Greer teaches people that he can take groups of people out at night and call in UFOs, and literally they do this. Teams of people go out, they wave flashlights at the sky, and they use telepathic techniques to let a UFO commander know they're here, and the idea is to get one to land. So he goes out and does this. He's always claiming that UFOs have come in and hovered around and that they have successfully called them in many times with ease. I went out with him in Minnesota, and nothing like that happened. And it was clear that he's primed to see things that aren't really there. The second we got out to a field, we were in a state park, he started hearing noises off in the distance in the woods that he said were crop circle noises. And somehow crop circles give off sound patterns, according to him, that are associated with the presence of UFOs. So So he started telling everybody, we're in a perfect location for a sighting, and I'm pretty sure that in that stand of trees about, you know, 1,000 yards away, there's a UFO hovering. So that's the kind of attitude he brings to it. We ended up going over there, and the sound that he was hearing was an owl sitting in a tree, and he sort of rubbed his chin and said, well, it sounded exactly like a crop circle noise, but it was just distinct in one tiny way. And that's what field work is all about. So it's a good thing we came in here and confirmed that it wasn't a UFO. So it's all kind of silly. But with Greer, the problem is when you talk to people who have worked for him, he believes apparently that he's in contact with an extraterrestrial entity, you know, somewhere out there, who has made it clear to him that he is the one person among all of mankind who has been chosen for contact when it finally occurs. And, of course, part of his message is that when this contact formally occurs, when a UFO lands and shakes hands with him and his group, that the whole world will be transformed. We'll have free energy. Governments will fall away because we'll realize we're all part of one big planet. So he sees himself as the forefront of, the most famous handshake in history. And that's why, you know, it's not quite as scientific as he makes it out to be, and it's not really harmful, but it's kind of bizarre.
No, a lot of the themes of millennialism used to be co-opted by left-wing millennial movements that thought that when socialism came or when the revolution came that we would all, you know, drink champagne out of faucets. And a lot of the groups that you talk about are either theocratic or libertarian, and in particular I'm thinking about the micronationalists, which the folks who want to build Pacific islands and have their own nations based on radical free market principles. Actually, our website for the Event Horizon is linked to the Millennial Foundation Web Ring, which was set up by Marshall Savage, one of the groups that you talk about. Do you think that there is a connection here between the collapse of collective or progressive ideological visions of progress and the kind of political tenor of a lot of these American groups that you talk about?
Well, you're right. There isn't much going on the left, which, of course, was one of the great utopian experiments of the century. It's mainly on the right now, and one of the hot areas is the idea of getting away from the United States government, not in the sort of right wing crank militia way, but in this libertarian Ayn Rand inspired method of starting a whole new nation somewhere.
And perhaps someday they will have that opportunity out in space. Look, Alex, I really want to thank you for coming on today. It's been very enlightening, and I want to encourage everyone to go out and buy Apocalypse pretty soon. It's a really great book.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.